Good morning. Welcome to our broadcast. You know, I was thinking, what's the best way to start our Sunday talks? And I came up with this question. You could say good morning. You could say good afternoon. You could say good evening. But to say good today doesn't work. Isn't that odd? Good today. Well, I have to talk to some of our editors and ask why. Why doesn't good today work? Anyway, so welcome to the broadcast. Today I'm talking about working on yourself. And I'll be sharing a little bit about what divine discontent is and why we want divine discontent. Also, I'll be talking about life direction and renunciation. And I have a lovely story to talk about in terms of why it's good to work on yourself. And then 6 or 7 points of how to work on yourself. There comes a time in our life where we begin to experience divine discontent, a discontent about who we are, what we are, and where we want to go in the future. With what do we want to do with the rest of our life? And this is something you want to experience. Usually doesn't happen until you're around maybe 33, 34, 35 years of age. Sometimes earlier, sometimes later, but the point is, let's say there's a 90% chance that you're going to have that experience in your life of divine discontent. This content causes us to search for direction, search for our life direction. And this direction is going to lift us, lift me, lift you, above our present way of life. So it doesn't mean that this divine discontent can only happen once in your life, but you do want it to happen at least once. In essence, at this stage of life, at this moment where we experience this divine discontent, we are now beginning to awaken to the urgings of our higher self. In other words, we are looking for some kind of enlightenment, an enlightenment that will help us to make sense of our own life and life in general. At this stage in our life, there is a willingness to make some changes and to begin working on ourselves. The process of enlightenment is the process of spiritual development. Enlightenment requires spiritual development. It requires working on yourself. In essence, a person has a deep longing to awaken a dormant knowledge within themselves. And this dormant knowledge is called straight knowledge. Straight knowledge is knowledge and experience that has been accumulating in your chalice. The teachings tell us that straight knowledge is intuition, but at an extremely high quality. Straight knowledge is a very high energy that manifests from our accumulated spiritual treasures. Helena Rourke said, "Often a simple woman has a better sense of straight knowledge than a woman graduate of a university." Here, Helena Rourke remarks, "Such a woman is simple, perhaps in the sense of not possessing social position or education, but not simple in the sense of lacking spiritual serenity." People oftentimes confuse straight knowledge, which is the result of many experiences of many incarnations. They confuse it with a certain psychism. According to our consciousness, one's consciousness, psychism manifests itself in a more or less dream, with dreams and certain perceptions of the astral plane. That's psychism, but it's not straight knowledge. Straight knowledge knows unfailingly the essence of things, the direction of evolution, and the future. So that's straight knowledge. It's not ESP. It's not a gut knowing. It's not anything to be found in the realm of psychism. It is strictly from your chalice, which is from a high, high level of intuition, refined level of intuition, and based on your openness and receptivity and connection to the spiritual treasures found in your chalice. The one who listens to the voice of their heart will more easily awaken this straight knowledge. The heart, we are told, is the best instructor in all the problems of life. And you see, we as a society don't yet grasp that. As a society, we think the intellect is the be-all, know-all of existence, that it's the intellect that guides us and directs us and helps us make our decisions. And this is why society seems to be steeping in so many earthly and material and relationship problems, because it's not the intellect that we want to listen to. It is the heart. And then the balance between the heart and the mind. That's where we find our best instructions, our best direction. Through straight knowledge, your heart says to you to help that person, or to sacrifice something, or to help that family, and you do it. In straight knowledge, you bypass your intellect, you bypass your logic and reasoning, because like an arrow, direct information will be given to you, and you listen to it. In straight knowledge, you ask a question, and you receive an immediate answer. But before you can awaken straight knowledge from within your consciousness, you must work on yourself. Working on oneself requires open-mindedness and a purification of consciousness. Why does it take open-mindedness? Typically, the normal thinking person, without having that open mind, will believe the causes to their problems is the result of everything that exists outside of themselves. This results in them being unable to take any sense of responsibility for their choices, for the situation they find themselves in, their relationships, for their financial position. But most especially, what I've discovered anyway, is our relationships. But if we work on ourselves with an open mind and have this beautiful connection with our chalice and spiritual treasures and straight knowledge, little by little, we begin to have glimpses of insight as to why that relationship is why it is, why our life situation is what it is, why we made certain choices and made certain decisions and took action based on those decisions. That's why we want to work on ourselves. Working on ourselves requires transmuting our old way of thinking. It requires removing bias and prejudice and opinions and justification. It requires eliminating one's ego. It means renouncing your past. This is not an easy thing to do, to renounce your past. Renounce how your parents treated you. Renounce what your academic teachers and friends told you. It means transmuting your successes and failures, your showing off, your reputation, and your many vanities. It requires us to renounce our self-importance. Obviously, this is not going to be done overnight. It cannot be done immediately. It takes a long time to face yourself, to have such an open mind that you are willing and ready, and now you're going to start working on yourself. And then you begin to take these problems within the personality life and begin to transmute them. It takes time, but it's an exciting adventure. So as you slowly take steps toward working on yourself, these progressive steps will show that you are showing signs of renunciation. Working on yourself step by step will find you renouncing time, energy, and matter to serve others, for the sake of others and not for the sake of yourself. For the strength of the future, each of us must strive for enlightenment. Enlightenment cannot come to us if we are living a comfortable life. Now, this sounds very strange, but I'm going to share a story about the life of Shakyamuni, and you will understand it, hopefully. But enlightenment, if we want enlightenment, we are told, it cannot come to us if we are living a comfortable life. And I was just thinking about the Dalai Lama, a story that he's told over the many years, that he was in a hotel. I mean, the Dalai Lama does not have any financial need. And he lives a life of comfort. That's how we see him, living a life of comfort. He's surrounded by his students who care for him and nowadays are helping him walk and so forth. But this story just stuck with me for some reason. I have no reason why. I don't know, really. But he said that he was in a hotel. He was giving lecturing at a conference that weekend, and his teacher came to visit him in his hotel room, and his hotel room was like a penthouse hotel room. And his teacher admonished him for living in that kind of comfort, and he said he immediately that night slept on the floor, on the hard floor. So that reminds me, enlightenment cannot come to us if we are living a comfortable life. We read legends and stories about great ones who left their comfortable abode and went out into the world, taking very little with them. And that's now how we see the Dalai Lama. He takes very little with him, except his followers. But he doesn't have jewels and Cadillacs and you know, houses throughout the world. You know, he lives a very simple life. We too must go out into the world to learn about the reasons for the pain and suffering of life. We must learn about the life and the purpose of life and the purpose of our life. We must serve, and in serving, we will undergo spiritual development. Helena Roark, who gave the Agni Yoga teachings to the world, wrote, quote, "Surely suffering is a great teacher and transmuter," unquote. Now here's the story. For example, Shakyamuni, the first historically recorded Buddha, who lived in India over 3,000 years ago, was born a prince. He was called Prince Siddhartha. We are told the prince was happy living in his father's palace. He was given all that was necessary, such as pleasure and happiness, music and dancing girls, flowers and trees, artwork and servants who were ready to act upon his command. But the heart of Buddha felt like a bird in a big cage, and it wanted to fly and see new horizons. Siddhartha went into the city to see life and experience humanity's life. After seeing the many difficult things, the prince put his hand over his face, and drops of tears came from his lotus eyes. He said, "Take me away. I cannot stand such suffering and pain. Take me back to the palace." When he returned to the palace, he told his wife, "There is old age, there is sickness, there is death. All those who are born must die. And how can joy settle itself in our hearts when sooner or later we will die? What is the command of your heart, my Lord?" asked his wife in tears of desperation. The answer later came when the light shone out of his being under the Bodhi tree. The biographies of these great lives, like the Buddha, show us the way. Their lives tell us in so many ways that we must work on ourselves if we want to serve humanity, if we want to serve the plan of the hierarchy. We cannot serve the future if we cannot renounce all that we have been. And I think also all that we have imagined. When we're young and our parents, not everyone's parents, but in the norm, parents inspire their children with what they want them to be and to become when they're adults. And through the dreams of the parents, the child begins to dream the same way. And then if they haven't experienced that moment of divine discontent yet, they begin to live a life of suffering and pain and questioning, and they're just disappointed in their life in general. But this beautiful moment of experiencing divine discontent, and in that moment, realizing that you are, I don't know how to explain it. It's like when you have that experience, when you have that moment, all of a sudden you realize that you are a certain degree away from your life purpose. And it is that realization that now enlightens you to the point where you want to change your life. And this is why renunciation is important. To renunciate your imagination and all those things that the dreams of your parents and teachers and friends and so forth, you know, said you're going to be this. Think of your high school yearbook and all those pictures of the different, you know, in crowd of who Johnny and Mary and Lily and Jim were going to be, because they are the most successful. And what oftentimes happens when you go back and you meet those people that were the apple of the eye of the teacher, let's say, they're failures. Why is that? But none of that makes any difference when you have that moment of divine discontent. And your life opens up in front of you, and you begin to recognize that your life has purpose, and that you seem to be a certain amount of degrees away from that life purpose. So when this happens, that divine discontent becomes more and more intense until you get back to center. Back to center means that now you know what your life purpose is, and that you begin to unfold the process of living your life purpose. So renunciation requires that we work on ourselves. To serve others on the path of enlightenment requires that we work on ourselves. Now here are seven major steps we can take to work on ourselves from the teaching. The first is elimination of our ego. This is such an important step, and the one where most of us fail for years and years until life brings us to our knees. What is ego? It is selfish and touchy, and it tries to give orders to others without being in a position to do so. Ego makes a person think they are very important, and they want praise for all that they do. The ego believes that everything will fail without their labor, presence, talents, and participation. They think they are the only one who can do this task, the job, give the lecture, teaching a class, writing an article or a book, better than the teacher or the leader. An egotistical person is a show-off. They boast and they shout to others. I mean, we know people like that, and they're disgusting. You know, they're disgusting to be around, as opposed to being around a person of humility. Their ego tries to convince others that they know more, and they are more important, and they are more special than others. I was thinking, I'm not sure this story ties in a little bit, but it was one thing I wanted to mention, because it's a phenomenon that I hear across the board so frequently, where a spiritual teacher will, in introducing themselves, say, I gave up a very successful position, or I gave up a very successful job so that I could become a spiritual teacher. And I've always wondered, why is that? That's ego. They didn't recognize the divine discontent that was taking place in their successful job or position or whatever realm of life they saw themselves in, air quote, called success. They weren't happy. They still were not happy with themselves. And that was such a valuable moment to them, but they didn't recognize that it was because now is the time to recognize what is your true life purpose. So it wasn't that they were so successful that they stepped down from their empire to teach us lowly people. See what I'm saying? It is now to really get into the trenches and learn about life. And who learns better about life than a teacher? Because they have to study before they teach. So egoism is a state of consciousness lost in the illusions of the mind, where the person feels that they are the center of the universe. To eliminate the ego, you must begin with the practice of humility. The first step toward the exercise of humility is to be quiet, to be silent. If you have a strong personality, you might find it necessary to stay in silence for several years, 3 to 5 years. During that time, you will engage in the science of observation. So if you have a strong personality, if you've had that moment of divine discontent, if you want to work on yourself, this is the first step to practice, is the science of observation. You will observe especially your thoughts about yourself and others until you learn humility. Humility is knowing what part of your personality is made from false images and what is a pure reflection of your greater self. The self is the divinity within you. It is the core of your being. Once people begin to work on themselves, they will discover many things about themselves. They will discover that they have many strongly held opinions about themselves, some true, some false. As they practice the science of self-observation, they will ask themselves many questions. In discovering the answers, they will learn that they have many mysterious self-images constructed by their glamours and illusions, their vanity, their failures and defeats, their aspirations and visions, their devotions, and this and that. Our images are built through many things and experiences that accumulate throughout the ages. We must discover which images are reflections of our divinity and which are false images that make up our ego. The ego, listen, here's a definition of ego. The ego is the soul, the human soul, plus that part of your nature with which you identify yourself, your physical, emotional, or mental mechanisms. This is straight out of the teaching, this definition. So this identification now becomes your soul's command post. And this is where the ego begins to spring forth from this command post. Through observation, you will seek to discover what you are and what you are not, so you can transmute and eliminate this ego. The ego is a fabrication of who we think we are. So that's the first. The second is meditation. Meditation is no longer an exercise of escape from the present or the past, but a path that leads a person into the future, their future. It is an exercise that will release them from their ego, from their vanities, and from their mixed up images that now has put them in such a difficult situation in their life. Meditation will find them with increasing health, increasing mental clarity, increasing in magnetism, and preparing you to experience direct knowledge. Meditation is a slow process, but if you engage in true meditation, over the years you will gradually make yourself ready for renunciation and become a pure, energetic server for humanity. One without pride. This is an energetic server. This is how we can define an energetic server of humanity. This is a person without pride, without vanity, without ego, without selfish interest. Meditation is an exercise where you begin to unfold your spiritual treasures found in the chalice, the lotus. It is not mysticism and it is not prayer. It is a daily labor that must be done with joy. So meditation and contemplation help us to experience the path of enlightenment and straight knowledge. Remember, the path of enlightenment is not limited to the earthly life. It expands beyond the earthly life to the planetary life and beyond into the fiery worlds. White Mountain Education Association offers over 20 meditation courses. If you are not engaged in meditation, you are invited to make an application for one of our courses. Number three, I'm returning to a little bit more to talk about the science of observation. The practice of self-observation is a powerful method, not only of self-study, but self-change. The practice of observation places us on the path of transformation. The science of observation is an intimate pathway into your own mind and body and spirit. It allows us to experience new levels of self-awareness, and by so doing, to live a more conscious, harmonious life. Because of our conditioning and because of our education, I believe most of us live our lives as unconscious automatons. And I know that sounds a bit ugly, but that's what I believe. How do I believe it? Because this is what I've observed. Until you have that opportunity of divine discontent and to work on yourself and to begin to recognize your life purpose, and then to find the ways to clear the path, to clear the way, so that you can begin to unfold and live that life purpose. We live in such a way that we are oblivious to our real divine potential, our soul essence. We live a life where we are totally identified with our personality, our self-images, and with whatever thoughts and feelings and images and daydreams are sensations that capture our attention at the moment. So to break this cycle and to work on yourself, practice the science of observation. It's free. There's no interest charged. Science of observation. Number four is nutrition and diet. Eating a proper and balanced diet is paramount. Proper and balanced. For me, the key word here is balance. Proper and balanced diet is paramount to our spiritual progress. And this requires us to learn about our nutritional and dietary needs. So much has been written about nutrition in the teachings, especially in Agni Yoga. I encourage you to study Agni Yoga to learn more about nutrition for spiritual students, and then fast forward it to today. Because over history, nutrition changes, and also over the history of our own body, as we get older, our nutrition requirements change. So we have to study and practice proper nutrition in a balanced, by creating a balanced diet. Where the nutrition of one may be different from another, there are certain fundamental truths. One is to abstain from red meat. Two, you should include in your diet a balance of fruits and vegetables, whole grains, nuts and seeds, ghee, natural cheese, herb teas, fresh juices, and water. Avoid sugar, white flour products, caffeinated teas, and processed foods. Avoid them. Don't become fanatical. Just try to avoid them. Some people believe that they must grocery shop at health food stores. I don't happen to be one that agrees with that. Today's supermarkets now are more than ever provide us with organic foods at a much lower cost than health food stores, which are just going off the charts with expense. But good health food stores can provide us with natural medications, such as homeopathic products, flower remedies, and so forth. Health remedies, which all disciples should study and familiarize themselves. Number 5, physical exercise. We are told that physical exercise can be fun if you create a variety. If you live in the mountains, especially in a forested area, the trees and fresh air of the mountains, they're going to vitalize you. Swimming is good for you. If you live on a beach by the Gulf or an ocean, you can easily allow time to swim in the ocean 1 or 2 times a week. Where, if it is possible, it is best to exercise in nature. Today's modern society does not always make it possible. In such cases, I suggest engaging in weight-bearing exercises, such as Health Rider, which is a non-electrical bicycle piece of equipment, and even try a jump rope, if you're young enough to do this. I cannot be a hypocrite and say, I do these things, I don't, but I did until I became as old as Methuselah. Anyway, you get my point. Do what you can. And during the winter months, you can even enjoy a treadmill. Number 6, study and service. Students of the Age's Wisdom should create a rhythmic study 30 to 60 minutes in the morning, which can include your meditation time, 30 to 60 minutes, 30 minutes in the evening, but before 8 o'clock. Don't study after 8 o'clock at night because it will keep you awake much longer. If you have developed a focus and concentration, studying beyond 8 o'clock will stimulate you so that you find it difficult to sleep. Save your time before bed by doing the evening review of your day. When you study, do not try to race through a chapter or a book. Take each page of the teaching and study it with great focus and concentration. See if you can go deeper and deeper into the layers of thought written on the page. It is important that you stay with the teaching, with this kind of study, for it will elevate your consciousness and to help you eliminate old patterns of thinking and crystallized thought forms. For example, say that you are reading about the nature of the heart. You will learn that a cosmic heart is the source of the Ageless Wisdom teaching. You can ask your questions about what you think the cosmic heart is. You will learn in your questioning that there is a reflection of the cosmic heart in your human constitution. Then you can think about this subject during the day, which will profoundly affect your actions, emotions, and thoughts. You will soon find yourself serving others through the nature of the heart. And number 7, observation of full moon group celebrations. The White Mountain Education Group has celebrated full moons since its inception in 1982. 2,080 full moons. Some of us have celebrated full moon group meditations before 1982. So how many full moon celebrations have you observed? To observe a full moon celebration is a solar celebration. It requires that we make ourselves ready prior to the event by way of purification of our physical, emotional, and mental vehicles, and also aligning our consciousness to the stream of approaching energies of the sun, which is now transmuting, at that moment, transmuting humanity. It means familiarizing ourselves with how the energies each month feel, how they're different, how they affect us, how they influence our thinking and behaving and actions. Because every constellation is different that the sun goes through. It means making some changes in our life. It means to participate physically, if possible, in a group meditation. If you do not have a local group that meditates together at the time of each full moon, then begin your own full moon meditation group, or you can join us during our broadcast. Meanwhile, we can provide you with information on organizing your own full moon meditations, and we can suggest materials and meditations for your monthly meetings. This is really a wonderful service that you provide your community. So this morning was just a little insight of why we want to work on ourselves. Mm-hmm.